Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it possible to be too smart for one's own good? At an age when many kids are struggling with verb tenses and stammering through picture books, Mark Oppenheimer wielded the vocabulary of a college graduate, read literature written for adults, and engaged in and sometimes won arguments over philosophy and politics with his parents' friends. But while you might imagine that made him the darling of every classroom he ever entered, the reality was that while his schools found ways to cultivate the gifts of students in math and science, they didn't really know what to do for a kid who excelled at talking. His superior intelligence alienated fellow students and even some teachers. Oppenheimer wasn't just bored, he was lonely. Things started to change in junior high when he discovered his natural-born gift for debating. Mark Oppenheimer is a writer, professor, and director of the Yale Journalism Initiative. His latest book is called Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. He'll be in town tomorrow to accept the Hyatt Prize in Humanities from the Dallas Institute for Humanities and Culture. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I want to talk about your title, Weisenheimer. It made me laugh because this is a word my mom liked to throw around when I was growing up. I'm not sure I deserve the label quite as much as you did, but it's not a word that people use very often today.
No, it's one of those wonderful antiquated words like a whippersnapper or something like that, I can actually tell, I can often tell someone's age based on whether or not they know the word when they ask, oh, what's your book called? And if I say Weisenheimer and they chuckle or at least, you know, recognize it, chances are they're somewhere over 40 or have parents or grandparents who used the word around them. And the kids these days, the teenagers I teach have no idea what the word means. But yes, it means someone who's a wise guy, a smart aleck.
How old were you when you first realized you weren't like other kids?
Well, you know, I think all kids probably enter some sort of consciousness that they're unique and special, to use the new age jargon, sometime at 2 or 3 years old. I mean, for me, there was something fairly obvious, which was that I was using words that my peers didn't understand. And it wasn't too long before I was using words that sometimes my parents didn't understand. I was just a word nerd. And one of the points that I make in my book, in Weisenheimer, is that being good with words doesn't have any connotations beyond that. It doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to be a very good writer or have any special wisdom or be a good poet. It's this gift that really serves no particular good for a young child, except if he likes talking to adults. Whereas if you have math skills, you know, those will probably stay with you. And you can predict that a kid who's very good at math at age 4 will probably be a pretty good calculus student in high school. But being good with language at age 2 or 3 or 4 doesn't predict very much at all, except that you'll get a lot of funny looks.
Did you ever try to rein in your vocabulary consciously in order to fit in with other kids?
Yes. Well, adults counseled me to. Mm-hmm. I remember in fifth grade, I think it was, being sent to the school psychologist. I hadn't done anything wrong. I hadn't broken any rules. They hadn't consulted with my parents. One day I was just yanked out of class and sent down to talk to this woman, and I was given some sort of fairly euphemistic description of what she did. You know, oh, well, she's just a nice lady who she's going to help you through some things. I wasn't aware that I had any things to be helped mm-hmm. through. But I think the teacher had noticed that sometimes I was talking past some of my peers and thought maybe it would be helpful for me to talk to her. And my parents fairly hit the roof when they heard that I'd been sent for, not that they have anything against psychology as a profession, but they, you know, they weren't aware that their son was being sent for counseling without their knowledge.
You have a really sympathetic description of your parents here. They were very proud of your abilities, but they did worry about you socially.
Well, and you know, now that I'm the father of three and my kids are very, very young, but you do begin worrying about your children and their peer group and how well they're socializing from the moment that they begin noticing that they have peers. And sure, I think my parents were tuned into some of my frustrations. They noticed that I sometimes wanted to be friends with kids who didn't want to be friends with me. And I should say here that I was very, very fortunate. I had some very wonderful friends from a very, very young age, and a couple neighborhood friends in particular whom I coalesced with when I was 4 or 5 years old are still my, you know, my two best friends in the world after my siblings. And so I did have friends, but even so, there were times when I think my parents would witness interactions with them where I was trying to get them to understand something and maybe they weren't picking up on it or weren't sure what I meant. And that would frustrate me. And I think my parents were quite rightly, you know, they wanted their child to be less frustrated and happier.
And you certainly didn't grow up in a vacuum. You were born into a family that really valued language, valued frank discussion, and they took your ideas and your opinions seriously from the time you were very young. Can you tell us a little bit about your family?
Yeah, my parents were both fairly political people. My mother's parents had been members of the Communist Party in the 1930s and 40s and were very political and thoughtful people. They liked talking about ideas. They had journals and newspapers around the house. They talked about ideas. My father was a very thoughtful person. He was a law professor when I was young. He doesn't do that anymore, but he's always been a reader. And so on both sides of my family, I was being raised by people and by not just parents, but grandparents and extended family who believed in the life of the mind, who loved to read, who loved to talk. But one of the interesting things in particular about my parents was, although they are big readers and do love to read, they're not the voracious readers that some people, I got to college and I met people whose parents, had filled the house with books and read, a dozen books a week or something. That wasn't necessarily what was unusual about my parents. What was, I think, unusual about our family was the emphasis on conversation. I mean, my parents would sit at the dinner table with a 5- and a 7-year-old and really talk to them about ideas well into the night. And that was very, very special for me.
They also tried really hard to provide you with educational experiences that supported their worldview and that would challenge you. And obviously, many of your classmates came from similar families. But while they had been raised to understand their parents' opinions about things, you were the only one who seemed to question everything you were told.
Yes. Well, getting back to the first part of your question, when you say ever so civilly that they tried to give me experiences that supported their worldview, I mean, let's be blunt. They sent me to nudist summer camp. I mean,
Nudist Quaker summer camp.
I mean, I think my father had a notion that he was going to give me all the experiences that in some version of his life he wished he had had. And he was raised by fairly conservative folks. And, like a lot of children of the 60s, he chafed somewhat at that. There was a gulf between his worldview and his parents' worldview. And I think he thought that I'm going to give my kid the mind-blowing experiences that I was never offered growing up in Pittsburgh. And so I was sent to a couple summer camps that were hyper-political. One was a Quaker summer camp that I should say the boys and the girls' camps were separated. They were across the lake from each other. But there was a lot of skinny dipping, and nudism was part of the practice of the camp, although since that time they've stopped because they ran into some problems with peeping Toms, I think. And then the following summer when I said no more nudity, because I was a pretty I like to think an appropriately uptight kid and did not enjoy that aspect. I was the one kid at the summer camp who insisted on wearing a bathing suit all summer. The following summer they sent me to actually a very famous summer camp called Camp Kinderland, which is an old Yiddish socialist camp that had a very strong left-wing political bent. And I hated that also because I was a kind of preppy conservative kid. I looked up to the Alex P. Keaton character from Family Ties on TV. And so it was not an age at which I was well-suited to left-wing summer camp.
At least there were characters in TV and movies by the time you were a kid that seemed a little bit like you. Of course, they were, a fictionalized version of that.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I like most about my book, and surprisingly, I like so much about my book, but one of the things that I tell people if they say, well, would I enjoy it, is I say, well, I don't know, were you a child of the 80s? Because a lot of, I think, the flavor in the book and a lot of the flavor in my childhood was that I did have these role models on television. It was this moment where there were these wonderful, geeky, dorky, male teenage figures. I mean, we're talking about Alex B. Keaton and Ferris Bueller and the Val Kilmer character from Real Genius and the Jason Bateman character on Silver Spoons and It's Your Move, back when he was a child actor before Juno and his very fine adult work. So, I mean, there was this incredible saturation of geeky white boys in the culture. And for me, these were role models because these guys were wise guys. They were smart alecks. They were good with words. So I was addicted to all of those shows and movies.
It never occurred to you not to, before you started formally debating, not to engage in debate with anyone with whom you disagreed or with whom you simply wanted to interact. And this included adults who thought, why is this 9-year-old arguing with me?
Right. And that was definitely a product of my family. My parents, there were certainly boundaries between parent and child. They weren't those kind of parents who were always trying to be my pal, thank God. Mm-hmm. But they did think that there's no reason children shouldn't question authority. I mean, ultimately, the parents had the the last word, and it was not an anything goes household. But we were certainly free to talk with them and to ask questions about anything, and they would take our questions seriously. So then when I went forth into elementary school or into conversations with adults I would bump into, I would, you know, quarrel with them, question things, ask them questions. And this didn't always go over so well because in a lot of our culture, children simply aren't supposed to ask questions. So a question that might actually be very polite and not at all aggressive if coming from one adult to another is often perceived as hostile and rude and, you know, intemperate coming from a 9-year-old. And I bumped up against that a lot.
And you would get mad, though, if your dad would step in and remind someone who was going crazy, having an argument with you, remind them, this kid's 9 years old or 8 years old. You didn't like that.
Right. Sometimes, and this happened in particular with a couple of their friends, we'd be at some sort of barbecue or something, and I would pick some political fight about whatever, abortion, affirmative action, you know, military defense spending. I don't know. You know, and again, it wasn't that I really knew anything about these things or had any wisdom. I mean, I had, you know, a young person's brief grasp from maybe having read a newspaper, but I would pick some sort of fight. And sometimes it was always amazing to me how easily adults would come down to a child's level. I mean, before you knew it, these 40-year-old law professors would be in my face shaking their fingers and fighting with me. And my dad would sometimes step in and say, you know, back off. He's just a kid. And then I would get mad. I would say, I am not just a kid. You know, what are you, Dad? You don't have to rescue me, Dad. But again, now that I'm a dad, I very much see it from his side as well.
Well, it is, I have to say, Mark, it's really poignant to imagine you having this extraordinary dexterity with language. You're curious about the whole world, but you don't yet have enough life experience to know what to do with that. And you don't believe that you're any different than this 40-year-old that you're arguing with.
Right. And the question of life experience is so important in the world of talking or writing or ideas. I mean, there are math prodigies who are doing adult level work at age 10 or 12. There are music prodigies. There may even be science prodigies. But there are no poetry prodigies and there are no philosophy prodigies. Wisdom and, you know, sophisticated use of language only comes with life experience. And you simply cannot have it no matter how advanced you are before 18 or 19. I mean, when you think about at what age could you plausibly do sophisticated philosophy or poetry? The absolute earliest would be in your late teenage years, but no earlier. You know, there's nobody at 10 or 11 who can really play with the big boys at that age. So there is something poignant. You're bumping up against these natural limits imposed by chronology, by your age, and you only time brings you up to that task.
So early in your school career, you had this woman that sounds horrible, Lisa, this teacher in Montessori school, and she made no secret of the fact that she just didn't like you.
Right. She was one of the worst people I've met, to be blunt about it. And she was a young teacher at a Montessori school. Looking back, she probably was right out of college. I mean, at the time, you know, adults are all adults. You don't really notice when someone's only 22 or 23 and perhaps very scared and insecure in a first job. But she was insecure and scared. And like a lot of teachers, and I am a teacher now, I know this feeling. When you haven't done the reading, you tend to resent the kid who has. So she didn't like me. When I challenged her, it really touched some sort of very, very painful exposed nerve in her. And the story I recount in my book is that she once publicly stopped the class and asked everyone if they liked me. She got down in my face first. She said, "You think you're so great? You know, let's see how great you are." And then she polled the whole class, said, "Who here likes Mark Oppenheimer?" And, you know, a couple hands went up, but it was a terrible experience.
Mark Oppenheimer is my guest. He's a writer and director of the Yale Journalism Initiative. He's accepting the Hyatt Prize in Humanities tomorrow. His new memoir is called Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Your You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and director of the Yale Journalism Initiative, Mark Oppenheimer. He will be in town tomorrow to accept the Hyatt Prize in Humanities. His memoir is called Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Mark, what sort of outlet did you find in pulling pranks?
Well, again, I was a, you know, fairly, I guess, smart kid like a lot of others and was looking for some outlet for that. And the science kids had their science fairs and the computer kids had their, you know, hacking and taking apart the their old Commodore computers or Atari computers. For me, I wanted to be clever. And I, again, being a kid, I wasn't really ready to be clever with literature yet, even though I had a big vocabulary. So pranks seemed like a kind of clever literary way to do things. One of my favorite books was Then Again, Maybe I Won't by Judy Blume. And one of the boys in that is a prankster. He does a lot of telephone calls that are kind of mischievous. And then one of my favorite TV shows in the brief season that it ran on NBC was It's Your Move with Jason Bateman, in which he plays this high school prankster. So you know, I started playing some very, very immature jokes, and one of the things I get into in my book in Weisenheimer is that a couple of them took a turn for the worse, and because of some prank phone calls I made, there was a family that got in some trouble. I reported crimes that didn't commit, and it was a whole terrible ordeal that actually got me hauled in front of the police when I was 10 years old.
That must have been hard for your parents to think, what is going wrong here?
Oh, yes. They thought they were doing a pretty good job. I was getting straight A's and I was playing Little League and I was winning third place trophies at chess tournaments. It was a standard Western New England upbringing. They were not prepared for that. And I absolutely think it horrified them. And the punishment was a funny one, actually. My mother was so angry that she said, I can't bear to look at you. You're going to have to go to your grandparents' house for a week. It so happened that this whole crisis took place right before our April school vacation. And I often went to my grandparents' house on school vacations. The irony of that, of course, is that going to my grandparents' house in Philadelphia was no kind of punishment. I mean, it meant I got to eat ice cream for a week and watch Benny Hill reruns with my grandfather and, watch Phillies games on television. It was the best punishment I ever had.
A little time out for your mom and a reward for you.
I think she basically decided that more important than anything was not having to look at my face for a week. And that if what that meant was that I got to go visit Grandma and Grandpa, she was willing to accept the dissonance in that punishment.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hey, great conversation as always. I just kind of wanted to throw out my own personal anecdote about growing up that I so sympathize with in hearing your stories. When I was a kid, I grew up in an extremely traditional, conservative Southern Baptist family, and also the culture and the region that I lived in. And so, as you can imagine, the question why, coming from a precocious little kid, particularly in education settings or at church, for goodness sake, was never taken very lightly. And I remember in particular one point. Being very young, very early in elementary school, and we're having a conversation about the existence of life on other planets or in other galaxies. And it was pretty much understood across the class based on what the teacher was saying, that there was no possibility of life anywhere else because of the different harsh conditions. And I remember raising my hand and saying, but wait, isn't it possible that another type of being could withstand the conditions that we can't? And the teacher actually started laughing at me, and so did the rest of the class. And so from that moment on, it kind of became my mantra that I was going to hang around with people that were going to give me the opportunity to do what I felt like was necessary to do, which is to ask questions and debate and so forth. And so it took me moving away from my family, from my region, my friends, and seeking out people who really fit more of the pattern, if you will, of being able to engage with people that had I stayed at home, I think I never would have gotten.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call, Jim. I know, Mark, for you, you had to sort of find your tribe as you got older.
Right. I mean, I love Jim's comment because it really does speak to the need for every kid to have a tribe. And as I said, there are there are mechanisms in place for creating tribes for a lot of kids. There are kids for whom Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts is the right tribe, or pick up basketball after school, or science fair, or science fiction. I mean, that's a tremendously important subculture for millions of American boys and also girls, is science fiction and fantasy literature, and the, you know, or video games. And, you know, a lot of this just didn't appeal to me very much. You know, for me, the tribe that I wanted to find was the talkers. And, you know, it's also interesting that Jim mentioned his religious upbringing, because I don't think it's entirely accidental that now I also write a religion column for the New York Times. That's in addition to teaching at Yale, I do religion journalism. And I think one reason I was so interested in studying religions and, you know, traveling the country and going to sermons in faiths other than my own and meeting religious people, some of them from pretty you know, despised religious groups, Scientologists, for example, was just that these are people who have found tribes, and there are often tribes that question or don't question to different extents. But I kind of love that culture of debate and question that I think religion is often at the center of.
And I guess the flip side of that is really openness, because if you are going to question everything, you're also going to question someone taking a group that everyone else has decided should be marginalized and saying, well, should it really?
Oh, yeah. I think that, you know, some of the people who, in my experience, have been most articulate on the subject of tolerance are actually religious people, because they have the experience of stepping into realms where they themselves are not tolerated. And this can be true even of someone who grows up Southern Baptist in, you know, in the South. You know, at some point in their lives, they're going to step into a setting where all of a sudden they're going to be the outsider. I saw this a lot when I was an undergraduate at Yale, was the person who had come from a town that was 100% evangelical, and then they step onto the Yale campus, and people think that their ideas might be strange. Not everyone thinks that, but they encounter people who might think that. I love writing about Scientologists, because they are constantly perceived as weirdos. And, you know, they can be normal as can be, normal Americans like me and you. They just have a religion that most of us hasn't been exposed to, and that, you know, has gotten some bad press for good and for bad reasons.
So let's talk about you finding your tribe. This, in your case, was the junior high school debate team.
Right. So after having a pretty rocky time at the Montessori school, where I had the somewhat sadistic teacher, and then having a couple good but spotty and sometimes plagued with legal troubles years at a public school, I went to a junior high school that was part – it was a private junior middle school that was part of a grade 7 through 12 school. So there was a high school attached to it. And the upper school, the high school, had a debate team. And I joined the debate team. And so here I was now as a 12-year-old, but I was on a debate team with, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-olds. And that was just magical for me. There was some conflict. One of the seniors didn't like me, and I get into the story in the book of how he ended up throwing me in a river that ran through the middle of campus. if the movie's ever made, I hope that scene makes it in. I think when I watch Glee and I see the slushies that are thrown in the faces of the choir kids, I always think, I was thrown in a river. It's not so different. But mostly, junior high debate was a wonderful experience, and we were on a circuit in Western Massachusetts. We debated other local schools. The topic was Star Wars, not the movie, but the old Ronald Reagan, the Strategic Defense Initiative, the missile shield system. And I did that for seventh grade. And then for various reasons, we didn't have a quorum to field a team when I was in eighth grade. But then I dove back into it in high school. And that became the central fact of my high school life, was debate team.
You know, the amazing thing about debate for a kid, as you've described yourself as being, is that you – so debate allows you this venue to argue about things and to get some facts behind your argument, but it also requires you to learn to read people. You're reading the judges. You're trying to evaluate what the other team might be doing.
Right. It would be very hard for an autistic kid to be a great debater because the one of the central talents is reading other people, anticipating where they're going, looking at how they scrunch up their faces when you make an argument, trying to think what their response is going to be. And it, in fact, is a very, very – at the highest levels, debate is extremely social and extremely – and it rewards kids who actually have very good people skills. So one of the misunderstandings about debate is that it's for kids who are total freak show weirdos. You know, pick your epithet. In fact, the very, very best debaters, they're not necessarily the cool kids on campus. I mean, it's not that they can compete with the captain of the soccer team or the cheerleader, but they are actually – people who are growing into very confident, very poised adults.
and the people who are coaching this sort of thing know exactly the personalities of the kids they're dealing with.
Oh, right. I mean, the coaches are some of the best people in the world. I mean, I think of my book in many ways as a tribute to some of the debate coaches, because they are really – they were philosophical and they were smart and they were interesting and they were totally dedicated to the team. And I know a lot of debaters who will say that the real intellectual formation they got wasn't from their classroom teachers but was from their debate coaches in this extracurricular activity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Mark Oppenheimer, whose memoir is called Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Pam who asks, when that teacher humiliated you, were you then able to tell another adult, your parents or another teacher or a counselor?
Pam, great question. You know, I can't remember, and I might have said something in my book. Now I'll be embarrassed if it's actually in my book. But it was one of the things where I had to go back and ask a lot of adults who knew me at the time, how did this play out? How did this go down? I think that for that particular incident, I was so humiliated and also so angry that I didn't tell anyone. I did tell my parents about other things that she did. She was generally just, you know, somewhat unbalanced. And I'll tell you an interesting story, which is I wrote a letter to the principal of the school as I was leaving. I left the school after fourth grade to go to a different school for fifth and sixth. And I wrote the principal, who was a pretty sane, stable woman, a letter in which I said, my teacher, Lisa, is unbalanced. She's insane. And you should know that and you should fire her. And, you know, I think the teacher, the principal got the letter and filed it away. But years later, about 4 or 5 years later, she saw my mother in the supermarket and she said, you know, Mark wrote us a letter about Lisa and we should have listened to him, because Lisa ended up really going crazy and they had to fire her. And then she started issuing death threats against the school principal. Mm. And there was an armed guard at the school for a while. I mean, Lisa really lost it. And, you know, I take some sort of measure of – I don't want to say pride, but I do – look back with a certain knowingness that I was onto her, that that there's a way that a child can see an unstable adult, an unbalanced adult, and that the adults around her couldn't quite see.
Well, it is always – it's creepy in a way, and this happens in classroom situations. Or I don't know about today, but I can say when I was growing up, there were teachers who would find a particular kid and just pick on that kid throughout the entire year.
Right. And I think teachers are some of the best people in the world, but there are – just as in any profession, there are people who shouldn't be in that profession. And it is, unfortunately, an outlet for some of them that they direct their anxiety or their anger onto that one particular kid who touches some nerve in them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Melanie in Fort Worth. Hi, Melanie.
Hi.
Hi, Melanie.
Yes?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, well, basically, I was just calling. I was listening to the show, and Mark, I was very much that child who started asking questions from the time I was born. I think my mom spent more time at my elementary school than I did having to explain my ways. But I noticed that it was a little more difficult for me, and maybe I'm wrong, but not only being a child that constantly questions, but being a female child.
Mm-hmm. I think there are definite gender differences in how different teachers relate to this. And I think on balance, girls probably do get the worst of it. Hopefully that has changed a lot and it will change more. I think it depends on the teacher. I know that in my own teaching, as someone who teaches creative writing a lot and journalism, the best writers, if I may stereotype for a moment, are more likely to be girls in my experience, or young women. I'm teaching at a women's college right now also. And so I find that I sometimes have to check myself against the stereotypes I have of boys who perhaps remind me of the kind of, somewhat doltish jocks whom I was afraid of when I was in school. So I think for every teacher it's going to be different. But culturally, absolutely, there is a certain stigma against girls who are too outspoken. And, you know, with my three daughters, I certainly I fear that I'll encounter that along the path with them.
So one of the things, Mark, that you picked up as you went along, in part due to the young woman who was, I guess, your first love, was the idea that sometimes it's okay to let an argument go.
Right. I mean, that's you know, I loved arguing, and I never understood why other people didn't. And I can explain it very simply, which was I loved arguing. I loved that sort of battle or contest the same way that some people love the contest of pickup basketball, or the way that I also love the contest of chess or tennis, or, you know, there people like competing, but people like competing in different things. And for me, arguing was the arena in which I liked competing. But I also discovered along the way that there were people whom I loved and whose relationships I valued who didn't like arguing as much as I did. And yeah, in the book, it was quite a pleasure to write the chapter that deals heavily with Nina, with my high school girlfriend, who was not by nature an arguer, who was a conciliator, a mediator. And I just had to learn, you know, there are other ways to happily relate to people. And you know, she was quite patient with me until I figured that out.
I guess it was also, it must have been a struggle for you to realize that while you could have an argument with somebody, it wasn't necessarily personal, or it wasn't saying that you didn't respect them or care about them. A lot of people take it that way when you argue with them.
That was tremendously shocking to me to figure out. I mean, even though I learned it over the years, I always seemed to have to relearn it, because I would find myself in the middle of an argument just having so much fun, you know, anticipating the person's next point and trying to think, what was I going to say, and thinking, oh, I got you on that one, or you got me on that one. Nice going. There was nothing personal about it. And it took me a long time to really internalize the message that some people actually got hurt feelings from arguments, because my feelings were never – I mean, my feelings get hurt in lots of ways, but it was never from an argument.
Is that wisdom, that realization, do you think?
Yeah, it's a little bit of wisdom, mm-hmm. Though it's the kind of wisdom a lot of people have intuitively. And that's one of the reasons I'm always careful to say that I was a fairly smart kid, but I wasn't a particularly wise kid.
Mark Oppenheimer is my guest. He is writer and director of the Yale Journalism Initiative. He'll be in town tomorrow to accept the Hyatt Prize in Humanities. His memoir is called Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. We'll resume our conversation with Mark in a couple of minutes. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mark Oppenheimer. His memoir is called Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You have a funny story in the book, Mark, of how you chose Yale over Harvard for your undergraduate work. But we should say the real part of the reason was the fact that Yale had this amazing debate team.
Yes. Yale was – when I was applying to college, Yale was just coming off being the first American team to win the World University Championships. And I had read about that in one of Yale's magazines. And so I did have this notion that I could go be part of that tradition. And, you know, I never won the Worlds, but I guess I did go to Yale and become part of that tradition in some way.
Well, it's I think it's one of the most fascinating chapters in the book, because having been a star in high school, it never occurred to you that you wouldn't be instantly welcomed onto the team.
Right. And I got to Yale, and about 2 weeks after the start of freshman year, the team held tryouts, and I didn't make the team. And all of these people, these other freshmen whom I had never heard of, made the team. And, you know, it was a classic story of getting to college and realizing how small your high school world had been. Because, look, I knew the kids from my own little New England debate circuit, but we actually didn't compete on the big national circuit that some of these other Yale freshmen had come from. So, in fact, some of the kids whom I lost a spot on the team to had won, you know, big national tournaments that had, you know, come after winning dozens of elimination rounds that involved tens of thousands of other kids. And when my book came out, in April, I was invited to be a judge at the big National Forensic League championships, which were held this past June in Kansas City. And when I went and saw, you know, how intense the debate world is across so much of the country, I realized finally, you know, at the age of 35, I realized, oh my God, my little world in high school in which I excelled was actually just a tiny little, speck in the ocean of competitive debate and oratory.
So you did make the team in your sophomore year, and ultimately you went on to compete at the World Championship. But it sounds like in hindsight, maybe not making it that first year was the best thing that could have happened to you.
Right. It was definitely in every sense of the word. It was the best thing that could have happened to me. I mean, for one thing, all's well that ends well. And as a senior, I did end up going to Worlds, and my partner and I were the top American team there. We didn't win. There was an Australian team that won, but we did very, very well, which was exciting. It was a nice note to go out on as a senior in college. But there were only good things that came from not making the team as a freshman. I branched out. I did a lot more theater. I did some intramural sports. I hung out. You know, I drank. I mean, I did the things college freshmen are supposed to do, and it all worked out well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Willard in Dallas. Hey, Willard.
Hi, Chris.
Go right ahead, please.
I wanted to ask Mr. Oppenheimer about the transition from talking to writing. He started out as an oral communicator, and now he is a journalist and a writer of prose. And I want to know what the connections are between those two things, because they're not necessarily logically connected.
Oh, that's a good question. I wish I were a poetry professor, because as I recall, they actually are very good on the topic of how literature did start out as oral in the ancient world, in the world of Homer. In my life, they were pretty much they proceeded together of a piece. They were both about the love of language. And I'm someone for whom I think it was never about hearing the sound of my own voice specifically or about the theatrical component. It was about the love of words, the meanings of words, the things you could do with words. It was about having grown up watching my grandmother do word jumbles and playing Scrabble with her. So there was a smooth transition from there into the world of writing. But I'm always very careful to tell my students, look, you know, I'm now a professional reader and writer, but I was not a kid who was one of the most voracious readers or writers. I was someone who got into it sideways through oral discourse.
Did you have any anxiety about the transition from having been a sort of wunderkind to being an adult, where a lot of other people have caught up to you by that point and are really good at what they do when they're, say, 30?
Oh, no. It was a tremendous relief. I mean, the reason that I was so excited to go to a selective college like Yale wasn't for the prestige or the chance to, you know, wear tweed jackets or smoke pipes. It was because I wanted to be around a peer group, all of whom had been achievers in high school. I wanted to be one of the crowd. I thought that was liberating. I thought it was healthy. And I continue to feel that way. Although my wife might find this hard to believe, I actually don't really enjoy being the center of attention. I'm certainly someone who has aged well into the idea of being a public speaker, in that increasingly I've grown comfortable with being a listener, which after all is what journalism is and what teaching is. You really, if you're doing all the talking, you're probably not doing those jobs well.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Allie in Dallas. Hi, Allie.
Hi. I also am a fellow Yalie. I went to Yale Divinity School and I'm an Episcopal priest. And I was really, and spent some time in Jerusalem. I was wondering if Mark had any exposure to the yeshiva communities, where arguing is really an art and a joy.
Well, that's a great question. And yes, I've been amazed. I wrote a book once about bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. I traveled around the country. I call it a bar mitzvah road trip, and I crashed bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs in towns everywhere from Lake Charles, Louisiana, to Anchorage, Alaska. And in that book, which is called 13 and a Day, I actually spent some time with a boy in Queens, New York, who was at a yeshiva and arguing. Basically, that is the ultra-Orthodox Jewish education, is just arguing about texts. And there is something completely breathtaking about it. And Stephen Greenblatt, who's a great Shakespeare scholar who teaches at Harvard, I once heard him say that he didn't really fully appreciate his Jewish roots until he had seen these young Jewish teenagers in an ultra-Orthodox school, you know, obsessing over the meaning of texts. And he thought, well, you know, there's something really glorious about that.
One of the things you argue for in the book is that we need to look at the way we educate children so that the ones who are, you know, whizzes in math and science certainly get the extra attention they need, but also that the talkers get the attention they need.
Right. I mean, American education at its best is very, very good with kids who display either great gifts or just great curiosity about an interest in math and science or math, science, music, certainly sports. We're very good at developing sports prodigies. But we don't tend to think of kids who love to talk as healthy in the classroom. In fact, we tend to tamp down those instincts and say, you know, wait your turn. And we try to sort of mainstream them for the sake of classroom harmony. And of course, you do have to teach kids how to listen and how to wait their turn. But if it's a problem, because if your natural exuberance is math, you're allowed to do as many math problems as you want. But if your natural exuberance is arguing, you're seen as a huge pain in the butt for the classroom. So we need to figure out better what to do with those kids. We need competitive debate to start earlier in school, I think.
Do you ever feel differently when you're at the head of the classroom and you have students who really want to spend the hour talking?
No, I like those kids, perhaps too much. I mean, I'm probably not as sensitive a teacher as I could be to the quiet kid in the corner. I think every teacher has his or her strengths or weaknesses. There are teachers who love working with the neediest kids or the sweetest kids or, you know, the most industrious kids. I really like the talkative kids, even if that talkativeness means that sometimes they speak out of turn. It's a group I do very well with.
You know, that's an interesting point. I have four kids, and it's interesting to watch that, you know, every couple of years they'll have a teacher who really understands how they think, and sometimes there's a teacher that is competent but maybe not the one who really lights them on fire. It's almost impossible to ask any one teacher to understand the learning styles of 20 or 25 kids.
Absolutely. And I think that in my experience, that has been one of the problems with a progressive classroom for me. When I was in Montessori school, you know, a lot of progressive education traditions, not all by any means, but a lot of them are very insistent on kind of the unstructured classroom with one teacher having, you know, multiple grades. So you have the same teacher maybe in a mixed grade classroom for second and third grade or second, third and fourth grade. That for me was kind of disastrous, and not just because the teacher ended up being Lisa, but in general, you know, I needed exposure to lots of different teachers. And when I went to public school where the bell rang and we moved on to the next teacher, that was actually great for me because I found more teachers whom I related to.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We will go back to the phones now and speak with Hassan in Ennis. Hi, Hassan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question to the guest about debaters and if debaters would be good negotiators. From my understanding and from listening, the characteristic is there. The question that I had, what is his thoughts on if politicians would use good debaters and negotiators like himself to create teams that will be part of the negotiation process for the peace talks that's currently happening between Palestinians and Israelis? Seems like politicians for the last 50 years haven't figured it out. So maybe if we bring in educated, highly skilled debaters, and like he said, he's also reached a point where he can be a satisfying negotiator also, when he talked about his girlfriend, and he reached to a level where he can stop from being pushy and let it go so he can be happy and make the other part happy. What is his thought if politicians were to use debaters into their teams, incorporate them to help them or guide them through the talks?
I think we got it, Hassan. Thank you so much. What do you think, Mark?
I think it's a great idea, and I think that from what I know of the peace process, not just in the Middle East but from other peace processes, the most effective meetings tend to be between some of the experienced negotiators whose names we don't always know. But a good leader will actually do fairly little of the negotiating himself or herself a lot of the time. They'll rely on people who often are better at conciliating and often know the issues much, much better. So there is some of that. And you do occasionally see these instincts in our politicians, but obviously not nearly enough because you know, on both sides in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they're very, very beholden to trying to please a whole bunch of different groups, and it becomes very, very political. So I think the leaders, unfortunately, end up suspending judgment more often than they should, and perhaps not trusting their experienced negotiators as much as they ought to.
Is there any relationship between the kind of debating that is taking place on high school and college campuses across the country and the thing that politicians do a month before they're trying to get elected?
No. There's almost no relationship whatsoever. The thing that politicians do in the campaign season is a travesty. It doesn't serve anyone very well. People should go to the web and find some of the footage of Rand Paul's debate against his opponent in Kentucky, probably the meanest and least productive Senate debate in history. I think it happened last night or the night before. It's just awful. And people who have practice in competitive high school or college debate cringe when we watch these episodes. The whole system should be redesigned. And of course, I have some ideas on that, but I don't think anyone's going to – the politicians don't want them.
Well, would it be possible to, by changing the rules, to get to some kind of discourse that meant something to people who were trying to make a decision?
Yes, it would be possible. You'd have to have fewer questions, and they'd have to be able to go on for longer about those questions. They'd have to be able to interrupt each other more. The moderator and all the questioners would have to play actually less of a role, because what happens now is they feel like, well, as long as I can fill out my 1 minute or my 2 minutes with sound bites, then I've done my bit. But if, in fact, a question were asked and then there was just 8 minutes of free-form discussion where they actually could call each other on things, they'd have to know more, and they would have to and the moderator also right now is so locked into this format for the sake of fairness. You get 2 minutes, then you get 2 minutes. And there's never the kind of following up or pressing people on questions where they've been evasive that there would have to be. So you need longer debates. You need fewer questions, not more. So it's very doable. I mean, any good high school or college debater could design the system in about an hour.
It's sort of sad that no one has demanded this. Or maybe people have, and that's fallen on deaf ears.
Well, they set up these debate commissions, the Presidential Debate Commission, every 4 years. And then what happens is they have to negotiate with each party, with each side, the Democrat and the Republican. And then there's always these discussions about, will the third party candidates be allowed in? But look, they aren't really interested in it. I mean, look at someone like Sharon Angle out in Nevada, who's avoiding the media altogether, and I think has consented to one debate, but under very, very strict rules that she helped negotiate. They aren't really interested in having their ideas tested and exposed. So the politicians won't go for it. And I'd love it if the people demanded it. Sometimes the people demand things like that improve the system, but better debates hasn't really been demanded by the electorate.
Yeah, I guess it never does make for a good competition when the competitors are the ones who set the rules.
No, that's perfectly said, right? Or when there's a negotiation between the competitors and one of them is always less articulate and has more to lose from the debate, or maybe is up in the polls and so doesn't want the debate because, why bother? If you're 20 points up, a debate can only hurt you. So they're setting the rules, and that's a bad thing.
Mark Oppenheimer is a writer and director of the Yale Journalism Initiative. He'll be in town tomorrow to accept the Hyatt Prize in Humanities. His memoir is called Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. Mark, congratulations on the award, and thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Yeah, it was a dream of mine to be on your show. I've heard great things about it.
It's very kind. Thank you. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.